Our liberties we prize, and our rights we will maintain. This is Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast, where we tell stories about the contribution Iowans and the state of Iowa has made to advance the civil rights movement. Past stories are being told, present actions will be highlighted, and preparation for the future will be discussed. Here is your host, Eric Anyange.
Welcome to the Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. My special, special guest today is Stanley Griffin Jr. He's one of the three kids of the great Iowa civil rights pioneer Edna Griffin and Stanley Griffin Sr. Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thanks.
I want to talk about your father as well, too, today. I want to tie both of their stories together from birth to the time they met.
I'm excited to talk about my dad because really all the emphasis has been on my mother. And it was only on certain events of mother. And what we want to do is expand people's understanding of who Edna Griffin was. She was a brilliant tactician, brilliant woman, and she made sure her children were very well educated and that we had the ability to communicate and be with all types of people.
What year was she born and where was she born?
Carlisle, Kentucky.
Okay.
I guess, and she was born, I think, I'm sorry because I don't have it in front of me now, but I think 1909.
Okay.
And what's interesting, I was doing research on birth certificates. A lot of times they didn't issue birth certificates for blacks at that time. They would have some witnesses who would certify this is when she was born on this date in this place, and that's what I have. I have a birth certificate, but it wasn't her original birth certificate. And what I found is with a lot of blacks, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm.
And then she moved to New Hampshire?
Yeah, they moved to New Hampshire. Her father was kind of a farmer. He worked on the dairy, and he ended up being a show horse trainer. And he became a fairly famous horse trainer up and down the East Coast. Her family was pretty much of a middle-class family, lived in the country, so to speak. So she didn't grow up in the big
suburban
city.
Okay.
And another interesting thing that she also grew up in the area where she lived, there wasn't a lot of churches, but a lot of the churches would not let blacks. There was mainly a white area, yeah. And they wouldn't let them worship there. But the Unitarian Church allowed them to worship there. So that's where she, and so she'd been a Unitarian all her life.
Okay.
When dad had more Baptist background, mother had a Unitarian background. So that's how, we all came to Unitarian.
Okay.
The faith, particularly when we moved here to Des Moines. The church that went, the First Unitarian Church just became our home and, it felt very natural for me.
Okay. So. And I see they have Edna Griffin Hall in the Unitarian Church here.
Right. We just saw that they just dedicated the main hall to the Edna Griffin Hall, and they're getting ready to, they're doing some portraits, some paintings of mom and dad and posting them in the church. It's it's a great honor. I mean, it's just so thrilling to me.
Okay, so she'd been a member of this church from the time they moved here in 1947.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if it started quite that early, but as long as I've been around, I don't know if it started when she first got here or not.
Okay, what do you know about your grandparents on your mom's side?
Well, now my grandfather's story is interesting too because he came from a large family, 10 kids, and at one point, because the times were tough. At about 14, they told him he had to go out on his own. He had to leave the house.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why he started working on farms. Working on farms, and then he became the dairy foreman. Evidently, horses were introduced to him, and so he just naturally took to that and slowly worked himself into one of the most famous horse trainers up and down the East Coast. And I actually had a picture of one of the horses that he trained, beautiful show horses.
What do you remember about your grandmother?
I don't remember anything.
Was she alive when you were born?
Yes.
Okay.
But the history is that I think my mom, after leaving the house, was estranged from her family. When I was born, I was in Iowa, and they were back east in New Hampshire. And they're kind of upset with mother all along. So she was doing her own thing, got involved with civil rights. The Progressive Party and the Communist Party actually as well. And that, you know, that didn't settle well for her dad. This, and I'll give you an incident of what happened. When she was doing her civil rights here early in Des Moines and elsewhere, the FBI started getting interest with her. At one time, went to their house to her father.
Oh, wow.
And was asking questions. Did they know that she was a communist? Her dad did not take that well. And so that kind of froze their relationship a bit.
Where did she graduate high school? Was that in Massachusetts?
It was in, I think, New Hampshire. New Hampshire, yes.
Okay. And then she went to Fisk University after that.
Right, which Fisk University, which was a top school for blacks at the time.
That was, 1928 when she went to?
Yeah, it was about 1928, approximately in that time.
Because I did not know she kind of got introduced to that civil rights.
Well, you could always, that was a natural type move. This was, Fisk University was an all black school, school.
Yeah.
And it's in the South.
It's in the South, yep.
And so it'd be natural that there'd be things happening because there's a lot of discrimination going on. I didn't know she was just so infatuated with civil rights, human rights. It was not only a black-white thing.
Fisk University, because that's when your mama met your dad.
Right, that's right. Both went to Fisk University. Dad was in pre-medicine. Dad was a self-made man as well because he worked to get his money to go to Fisk University. And he did some jobs on the shipyards and stuff like this. But I believe he financed his way through medical school in Massachusetts. He went to a medical school and a surgical school in Massachusetts.
Oh, so after they both graduated from Fisk University, they moved to East Coast?
Yeah.
Before they came to Iowa.
Yes, okay. So they had other life.
Where did they go? Was that in New York?
Well, see, now it's a little sketchy where if they all both were there at the same time. But they went back there because Dad was in medical school. Keep that in mind. Yeah. And so Mother spent some time in New York. And at one time, she tried to join the United Nations as an interpreter. They were not accepting black females as interpreters. That did not work out, okay?
Oh, wow. When did they get married? Do you know?
I do not know. They didn't really talk much about their relationship because I was wondering that myself. I was talking to my sister, Phyllis, the one who was involved with the demonstration, my oldest sister.
Yeah.
She does not know either when and where they got married. They didn't talk about that.
Well, we're going to put it this way, because your mom graduated from Fisk University in 1933. We're going to say that's the time they got married, 1934, right after that.
Yeah. Well, no. Yeah, that is what you would think. But as I said, they didn't really talk. You know, and we're pretty young, too. So, it was nice to sit down with the microphone and say, okay, parents.
Yeah. What did
you let us, when, where
let
were
us
you?
Know.
But anyway, I'm sorry that, because we're trying to stitch together every year that they were together, but it wasn't that type of thing to do that. They didn't really talk about that.
Now, your mother, you say she had four brothers.
Yes, they may have been the oldest, incidentally. And she was the only girl in the family.
Oh, really?
She was the oldest, and they were younger. Some of them visited us in Iowa, and I met some of them. Some of them I did not. I have pictures, and I've talked to my cousins and stuff like that. They all did very well, very intellectual, doing quite well.
Your parents moved in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1947, in 1948, the Katz drugstore case
popped up.
And so it's like your mom just hit the ground running.
Well, here's another one for you, and we're still trying to figure out the order of this. Everybody knows Mother as a WAC, Woman's Auxiliary Corps, which was in Fort Des Moines. That's the only place that they trained officers was here in Iowa, incidentally. Yes, and a lot of people are familiar with that because they've seen a picture of her in her uniform.
Yeah.
I think she came to Des Moines before Dad because, as I said, Dad's been involved with medical school, so she was in the WAC.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to figure out what the world brought Dad and Mom to Des Moines.
Yeah.
And they didn't talk about that one either. There's a reason they settled
in Des Moines.
In Des Moines. Dad had earned a MD medical degree back in the East Coast and did his internship in Wilmington, North Carolina. And so he successfully completed everything he needed to do to be an MD in North Carolina. But they would not allow him to admit his patients to their hospitals. And then to be told that you cannot admit your patients in their hospital, he was devastated. But I think Mother had convinced him. See, Mother, I think, had been exposed to Des Moines before that and maybe had known about the osteopathic college there and said, well, listen, you know, you're going to have to get yourself together and maybe, you know, move to Des Moines. We're going to move to Des Moines.
Yeah.
And you're going to set up practice in Des Moines, okay? So yeah. There's a period where he was kind of, I'm sure he was kind of depressed because what do? You don't just, yo.
Yeah. So he came to Des Moines. Did he have to go back to college for the medical school?
No, he had a relationship with Steele College. It was called Steele College. The osteopathic medicine school here was called Steele College at the time.
Yeah.
Yes, he must have taken some class there, but he must have got credit for them in medical training he had.
With the class he got from North Carolina.
And he ended up being an instructor. He never talked about that at all to us. And he finally opened a practice on the east side in 1948. I even got a picture of his Gordette Brown, his first patient and stuff like that was over on the east side, right by the Capitol. He had an office over there is what's going on.
We established that your mother was born in Kentucky in 1909, graduated high school 1928, went to Fisk University, graduate day 1933. That's where your mom and your dad met. What year was your dad born?
Well, see, now you're really going to embarrass me there. I think about 1907, let's say 1907 or so, in Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
Okay.
And his family was fairly well off, too, because in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, there's Elizabeth City State. There's a black college there. We had a property there. Sarah Griffin, I guess my great-great-grandmother, owned like about a block of land down there, and that's where a lot of the family was born down there. The Griffins were from that area there. Oh.
How many siblings your dad had?
I think five siblings.
Where was your father rank on the siblings? Oldest, youngest?
See, now that's a good question. Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I'm not sure about that. I think he may not have been the oldest, but he was one of the older people.
Your dad played a huge role for your mom to be this civil rights pioneer.
Yes.
Because I'm sure he financed a lot of the movement.
That's why I wanted to talk about my dad. He was the main foundation of our family. If he wouldn't be the bread earner, self-employed, Mother could not have done what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And no one will say that it was easy, the relationship, because here's dad, a professional doctor, where some of the other doctors' wives were just doing their thing, doing their thing. They weren't worried about civil rights. Well, she was writing a column in the Iowa Bystander, which is the oldest black newspaper in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And she had a column called Different Strokes for Different Folks. And she used to write about everybody. I mean, she did not bite her tongue about things that, editorial stuff about people that she thought weren't doing the right thing. And so the contrast between my dad, the professional doctor who helped people, had to be a strain on my dad because the other doctors, their wives were not doing this type of stuff.
Did your dad own his own medical practice?
Oh, yes. Okay. He had his own medical practice from 1948 on, yes.
There's a lot of people in Iowa considered your mom as the agitator and a troublemaker. So how much did that perspective in Des Moines affect your dad's practice?
I don't think it did very much because there was a big need for black doctors in the area. And everyone liked him and he was associated with Omega Psi Phi brothers. And so they all had a network. Obviously, they all worked together. I don't think affected him in that way. And luckily, he was self-employed. Now, if he would have been employed by a hospital somewhere else, now
they would let him go.
And now that was the deal with Mother. Mother came here and she did not have to have a job. So if you're trying to recruit civil rights activity and protests in the community, people are a little skeptical of doing that because they want to keep their job. If if you were a 9-to-5 wage earner, you didn't want to put your job on jeopardy and wherever you worked, Firestone, or if you worked at wherever you worked, you didn't want to totally get involved.
Because, you did not want to put yourself out there and get fired. I want to cycle back a little bit. So your dad was born in North Carolina and grew up there. finished high school there. Then he went to Fisker University?
I believe so. Yes, he went. Yes. And so there may have been something in between because he had to, you know, he had to earn money.
From 1933, let's say, they both graduated from Fisker University. They did not move to Iowa until 1947.
Right. So that's that's when I think they that she went to New York and was working with a different organization. She was still doing stuff in New York and maybe applied for the UN interpreter. And Dad was probably in medical school, so it took a while. Hey, he had to raise money.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's not like he went through in four,
Yeah.
I don't think he went through in like 4 years. So there's a period there. Yeah. And so I've been trying to piece together where they were and when, but they didn't. It's not like they outlined for us.
1947, they decided to move to Iowa, and then they ended up called Iowa home for the rest of their lives.
Right. Well, what happened was, we moved on Third Avenue, right by where Mercy is.
Okay.
Now, actually, Mercy annexed where our house used to be. Well, at the time in Des Moines, we first lived on Third Street, but we bought our house on 44th Street. It was redlined. Dad could not buy his own house. I find out that he worked with the Hansons, the white farmers. They bought the house, and Dad paid them for the house. That's how we moved into the house. That's how we got the house.
Oh, wow.
We moved in at night to 44th Street, and they erected a six-foot fence around our backyard the next day, incidentally.
What year was this?
This was in about 1957 or 1958.
Oh, cool. So your dad wanted a house, but he cannot buy it.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, that was a typical story with a lot of black families. Redlined as far as where you bought them. So as I said, in order to be able to get it, someone else bought the house for us and Dad paid them.
So did you guys act like renters?
No.
Okay.
No, we owned the house, and that was only between us and the Hansons who bought it, really.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were a little bit stunned to see that there were some black folks living next to them.
So now, did the Hanson have to put their name on the deed?
No,
they did.
No, they trusted Dad enough. They were close enough.
Okay.
I started school at Windsor Day School, which was a very elite school. See, I didn't realize that I was going there with kind of the lead Des Moines. That's where I went to school, was this private school. And they shipped me over there by cab. I may have been the first people bussed in Des Moines because I had to take a cab back and forth from Windsor Day School. Yeah, Windsor Day School was right by Roosevelt School at one time.
Okay, there was no buses? Or?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
Oh, wow.
No, so I took KK. They sent me by cab a lot of time, yeah.
How many black kids were in your school?
About two or three at the time, yes. I didn't think it was anything different, but I look back and go, wow.
I did not know this. Your sister was born almost immediately after your parents moved to
That's correct.
Iowa.
No, that is correct.
Yeah.
Yep. And so she was involved with the Katz drugstore.
Yeah.
She was a person, the infant that was talked about when... And another thing about the Katz drugstore incident from Third Street, we told you we lived on Third Street.
Yeah.
Well, they say in the newspaper article, you'll notice that they said she walked down to Katz. But if anyone took that journey in a car, that's quite a ways. And if this was, and they said that the temperature was like 80 and 90 degrees.
Because it was July.
That was hot. That is a long way. No wonder they needed something to drink. Because when you hear the story, you don't really realize how far they went. And she was in a stroller. She said they walked down in a stroller.
Mm-hmm. They say the brilliance of Edna Griffin is the ability to navigate through two different worlds at the same time. As a radical activist and also as traditional doctor's wife.
Absolutely, and a columnist, different strokes for different folks.
I want to get back to the FBI before we go to the Katz drugstore case.
All right.
So your mom was a member of the Communist Party
back in those days. And what's interesting is we call it Progressive and Communist Party, yes, which incidentally, I had no idea.
Which that will make the federal government very nervous.
That's correct.
And they start looking into your mom. Actually, they thought she was radical enough for the FBI to start looking into her.
And they were watching her for about 10 years at least. We did do a Freedom of Information request and have the files. But see, what I'm saying is this is what it showed me that she's like three steps ahead of them. And she's not doing anything illegal. They're watching her very closely. But here's the deal. After all this time, they had nothing on her.
Yeah.
She knew that this was going on.
The FBI say from 1947 all the way through 1965, they had about 400 information collected about your mother.
Oh yes. And like I'm saying, she was like three steps ahead of what they were doing.
So let's get to this, the most famous case. At this point in 1948, Katz Drugstore, they were already being sued about 14 times.
Absolutely.
And they won all these cases.
And they were arrogant about it. Oh yeah. They didn't care.
So they were bolded with all these wins, because they were not hiding. They say, we do not serve colored our restaurant.
Absolutely.
And they won all those cases.
Right.
Your mom knew it.
Right. Had studied that and studied the law that was on the books from 1884 or something and said, okay.
Yep. And that's why it's funny. The more I read about the case, Katz, he tried to use that your mom was causing trouble.
Oh, she could
go anywhere else to get a drink, but she chose that store. Your mom chose that store purposefully because she knew the history.
Oh, obviously. It wasn't a coincidence that she walked in there.
She walked in. So this was pre-planned.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to walk in there, and we know they're going to refuse to serve us.
And then they wanted to say that she's a rabble-rouser, and she wanted to disrupt her, that she was just a typical thug, hoodlum.
Yeah. On July 7th, 1948, your mom and two other guys, John Bibbs
and Leonard
Hudson, walk in the Katz drugstore. They sat down. They ordered drink, ice cream, and actually— the waitress
was going to order until the manager saw that and said, wait a minute, you can't do that. You know.
And they were straightforward with them. We say we are not serve colored people.
The quote was, and some of it, we're not prepared to serve colored people. They don't have proper equipment to serve colored people in there. Let me tell you, that's why Mother really got mad, because she had observed, even before this, how blacks from the community would go in there, but they knew their place. They'd go in and order food or buy stuff from them, but not sit down at the counter. You could order stuff to go, but don't sit down at the counter.
And your mom knew this.
And Mother was watching this saying, these people are so complacent. She couldn't believe it. She said she was shocked that it was just the way it was, so to speak. So we're gonna support Katz Drugstore, and yet they're discriminated against us. So that
and I think I read a statement. NAACP back then, they could not fight them because most of the black people did not want to become a witness.
Well,
they
did
not want to be part of.
She came, as I said, Omega Psi Phi and stuff. So she started working with the top attorneys. And another interesting thing that caught my attention is the Register and Tribune, the newspaper, the biggest newspaper. They were located across the street, and the reporters would come in there for their meals, but yet they didn't report. They didn't put this stuff in the paper, what was going on.
Wow, I did not know that.
Reporters would come in there for their lunch, but they were not reporting like on a day-to-day basis on. That's why you don't see a lot more pictures and stuff like this, because they didn't report on it. You think you'd see a lot of articles going, oh, yeah, yo, that Griffin's up to what she's doing again, or, you know, these people.
Yeah.
But there was—
because there was a people protest, so reporters has to see that.
Right. They had to see what's going on. So this is the biggest newspaper in Iowa.
Why do you think they didn't?
I guess they were told by their editor, who knows, by their editor that they, or maybe they did want to say something. They said, oh no.
Don't give you publicity.
Yeah, and don't get involved with that.
Yeah.
But I thought that was ironic that you're sitting in there, they're coming in there to get their lunch and not reporting on the story.
Your mom and these two other guys, they ended up suing Katz Drugstore, civil case and criminal case.
That's what they did. If you study that case, at first they won initially, but then Katz was still not done. They had to go back again.
Mm-hmm.
They had to go back again. They went in there. They had won some earlier stuff, but they had to go back in because Katz was saying once again, oh, we're not going to. Not listening to this. And I love what happened at the trial. The waitress that wanted to serve them, they fired her. But during the court thing, they found her. And she appeared in court and testified about what happened and what they told. Yeah, because they were saying that she was, you know, mother and them were defiant and causing trouble. And so she came in there and said, oh, no, we were just serving them. They wanted her to disappear, this waitress to disappear while she resurfaced.
Because it was going to contradict with their story.
Oh, yeah. And they had won. They were so confident about them. You know, they'd won every other time.
Yeah. The case, actually, they filed the case like 3 days after they got denied to get their ice cream, get their drinks. And the case was held in court on October 6th of that same year.
And, you know, but it was going on for a while because Katz was not accepting,
of course,
the decision at all. So they had to go back and mother find anti Jim Crow organization to fight, you know, fight that. It even got more support from the community is what's going on.
And then the Iowa Supreme Court issued the decision, and court basically was on your mom's favor.
Yes. They finally enforced the laws that were in place all along for people. Mm-hmm. That's what's interesting. I just want people to know that the law had been there, but
since
I guess you had
1884.
Right. They just never enforced it, is what was going on.
Yeah, there's basically was no punishment for discrimination.
But you know, another thing that I thought was very interesting, telling, was, did you see what they awarded them? That was curious.
Was that like a dollar?
There was a dollar. Then the most that they got was $1,000. I mean, yeah, and I don't think the money was the point, but they could have hurt them with, they should have, any time now, they should have hit them with way more fines, because this, they had been going on with this a long time, and they thought they were going to be slick. I guess they still thought they were going to win until the end. And then they said, okay, we're going to drop this. So they finally said, after a while, we're going to drop this. We're going to let black people, and so we can make more money. This is what, wait a minute, it makes them earn more money. If it was me, I'd say we'd boycott. No, we're not going to, even if we won, we ain't going to Katz. We'll go somewhere else, because if you don't want our business, we ain't giving it to you.
And I don't think your mom and the other two guys real cared about the money than changing.
It was not about the money, and therefore it had an impact all over Iowa, what they did as far as equal accommodations and going into restaurants, and it affected them, because Katz, I think, was headquarters out of Kansas City. And the beauty was there was no violence, no one arrested. It was a white and black protest together. That is the brilliance about my mother. On the Katz drug store, I want to throw something in here. I want to give a shout out to Roxanne Conlon, attorney Roxanne Conlon. We were here for a celebration a few years ago, and she took us to, me and my sister, the girl that was involved with the fraud, to lunch. I did not know. She advised us that she worked at Katz as a waitress at one time. This is a civil rights attorney here in Iowa who's very well known. And she worked at Katz and became friends with mother and started help sponsoring stuff that she did. Subsequent to that, her and her husband bought the building at 7th and Locust and decided to rename the building the Edna Griffin Building. That's why it happened.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, I'm so proud of that, and I just want to give her a shout-out that I'm proud of her. That's what mother's all about, the coalition between whites and black. That's what it takes. That's what changing your community means. You have to get everybody involved.
Shout-out to Roxanne, man.
Hopefully she'll be listening to this, because I really appreciate people sticking their neck out and helping each other, and that's what we need to do in the future.
When people call your mom the Rosa Parks of Iowa.
Uh-oh, you know that's going to start something. And that had been going on for years, and we're going, they finally corrected that, because what Rosa Parks did was like 5 years, 6 years
later
than that. So Rosa Parks is the Edna Griffin. It's technically
it's the other way around.
But and then Wayne Ford, incidentally, he's a organizer here in town. Now, this is something a lot of people did not know, that he got, they got together on a phone. They got Rosa Parks and mother and mom on the phone, and they were talking to each other. And he said that Rosa said that she was proud of mom, and that she was proud of mom as well, the dynamic. So they did have a little conversation on the phone about what was going on in the protest and stuff like that. Not about that she was getting all the accolades. Technically, it was the other way around.
What was the backlash your mom got from the people in Iowa for doing what she did? Because what she did was honorable, but not everybody accepted it.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, well, you know, see, that's a delicate topic there, because at the time, as I said, 1947, yeah, there's some people resented her stepping forward for change.
And I know your parents did not talk a lot about this stuff, but did you hear anything? Was there any threat on your mom's life, your dad, your family?
Yes. Oh, yeah. She was fearless. Let me say this. Mm. She was fearless about stuff like that. As I said, the next day we moved in, they were erecting a fence. But they also threatened. We found out that there's a church right down the street from where we live, 16. I won't mention the name of, but they had a meeting to talk about burning a cross on our lawn.
Oh, wow.
Okay, but besides that, yeah, she probably received all kinds of threats for what she, you know, what was going on. But she never came across as being upset.
Let me back up a little bit. Your sister Phyllis was born in 1947.
Yeah.
Then your sister Linda
was born 2 years. We're 2 years apart.
2 years apart.
I was born in 1951.
Okay.
And I was the baby.
So a mother of three kids, the foot so deep in activist. How was that for you guys growing up?
Oh, see. Now, see, that's a kind of a controversial question there. You really trying to push the edge now. but yeah, because I was just talking to my sister about this topic. A lot of times, well, I was the youngest also, the baby. And I sometimes felt she was not around. I mean, I think one of her kids was her civil rights work, mm-hmm. you know, and because we're looking around going, well, where's mom? She? She's either organizing. She's dealing with other people's issues and stuff like that. And so that was kind of the more I look back, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really think about that or the effects on you. But recently I've been thinking, you know, yeah, she was not around.
She was married to the movement.
Yes. When she was into the movement, she went deep into the movement and was going to help them. And I'm not sure if she was totally aware of the impact on dad and the kids a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's why I certainly want to talk about my dad. He held down the fort. As I've grown up and I was reflecting with my sister Phyllis recently, I said, you know, a lot of times mom was, you know, not there. I'll give you one example, but this is one that I guess was still bugging me as of today. I played cello from fourth grade all the way through high school, and I competed. They had competitions, solo competitions. And this is when I was at Roosevelt High School, and I had a solo. It's memorized and stuff like that. But mother was my accompanist, so I'm sitting there waiting. You know, there's other people. Everyone was performing, but she hadn't got to where we were. You know, the room that where we were yet, right? So I'm sitting there, waiting,
looking for her.
Mother never shows, and then they say, "Well, Stan, you're either going to have to perform. You know, what are you going to do?" I did my solo without an accompanist and got my blue ribbon. Mm. But what's really weird, after that happened, you know, I went home, but I don't recall she said, "Stan, I'm sorry I couldn't make it. Here's what happened." She just went on like nothing happened. I'm going, damn. I mean, because that was, you know, think about that. I was a young kid and I'm going, my accompanist did, you know, she was so, obviously had something going on, or she just plain forgot it or something like that. But just,
and you go like, "You got something to tell me, Ma?"
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, that just stuff like that. I mean, because I don't recall. And then there was one other instance was going on where there was a job opening at AT&T or something like that.
Yeah.
And we had to take a test and do all this. So I took the test. Everything cool. I think I passed. Everything was cool. I come back and said, "Well, Mother, how about that job?" Evelyn Davis's son and I applied for the job. I didn't know this, but he said, "Oh yeah, we gave it to Evelyn's son instead of you. You basically. I didn't need the job." So wait a minute. I'm going,
you could give me a heads up.
Absolutely. He probably needed the job, but I'm saying, yeah, give me some idea. Or do something about it. Like, it's stuff like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't feel too sorry for me, because I took horseback riding lessons. I took art lessons at the art center. I did all kinds of stuff, but you would like to. I mean, I have no problem. Yo, just talk to someone, will you? I mean,
if you look in a bigger picture, you took the heat for the whole state.
Right. I'm sure like Martin Luther King's kids were probably thinking the same thing. They're
absolutely
going, where's dad? They're seeing him in the paper and the news all the time and saying, yo, it'd be nice myself if I saw my dad. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think as a black kid growing up at that time, you grew up a little bit privileged because of your parents' background?
Heck yeah, yes.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Did I consider at the time? You know,
compared to other black kids,
did I consider it privileged? Yes, I would say so.
Your mom lived to be 90,
right?
Very great life, as far as I'm concerned.
It's kind of amazing she lived to be that long because she was a diabetic.
Oh wow!
She had to take. I think she took shots. She was a diabetic, and she loved chocolate. Oh, she always. And then when I tried to check her on, I said, "Mom, you don't need to eat that chocolate. Mind your own business."
Know what I've done for this state.
That's right.
Don't tell me what to do.
That's basically what she did. She put me down when I was trying to protect her health. That's kind of what happened to me there.
When you get to my age, then we can talk about health.
That's exactly what she said. And then I backed up. But then I'd remind her again of, you know.
So she was taking those shots insulin every day?
Oh, yeah.
She was out here not making excuses, just keep fighting.
Oh, no. That's correct. She fought until the end.
Boy. Now, all you Griffin kids did not want to settle in Iowa. You moved, your sisters moved. Why you guys did not want
to? Uh-oh, so you're getting touchy. What, you think you need to ask that question?
Griffin made history here.
We need, let's put it this way. Simply, I needed some diversity. I wanted to see what else was going on. I mean, Des Moines is great. Don't get me wrong. I'm an Iowan, okay? So I don't claim to be anything else. But I yearn to see more diversity, to meet more of us. I mean, where there's a higher percentage.
But I got to push that back a little bit, Stan.
Okay.
I got to push that back a little bit.
Okay, now hit me with it now.
Your mama wanted to see change. She did not run. She made it happen.
That's right. Now you're trying to get controversial. No, I didn't run. I guess I didn't see it like run. What took me out of town initially was college and stuff, okay?
Yeah.
I attended the University of Iowa, University of Colorado, which I had 2 degrees from there.
Yeah.
So I got around. And you get exposed to
a lot of different things.
Because at first, growing up in one place, you don't really know what the rest of the world is like, okay?
Yeah. You know,
I've traveled around the country a little bit. And so you get curious about what else is going on.
You're right. To be fair, your parents also.
Oh, so you're going back? Oh, wait a minute. Oh, you're backing up.
I'm dumbing down a little bit.
I'm bigger than you, too.
Because your parents moved around a little bit before they settled in Iowa. So it wouldn't be fair for you to be born and raised in Iowa and then die in Iowa.
Right. I mean, and I think that was natural because a lot of people from Iowa, like, moved to Colorado, for instance. A lot of friends, whites, people move from other locations.
Yeah.
And, for instance, I live in the Atlanta area now. And I love Atlanta is a mecca for black people as far of all income stratas.
Yeah.
There's all these colleges there, musicians and stuff like that.
So. Yeah. What is the legacy of Edna Griffin?
I hope the legacy of her is one world, one peace. Everyone getting along. We are all together in this world. That's the only thing I've been taught. Get to know people. Why do foreign exchange students come here? So they can get to know America. Other people and stuff like this. And if you don't have interaction with people that are different, well, you won't know what they're like. The story is the same. Once you start interacting with people, you say, dang, they want the same things.
Mm-hmm.
They want their kids to be successful, educated.
How do we honor Edna Griffin going forward?
Well, bring people together. People just need to think deeply what they can do to make a difference in people's life. You know? So whatever media it is, everyone needs to find a niche that helps them speak out. But don't sit back and just let a path y'all be jaded. You need to do something positive, whatever it might be. It doesn't have to be any big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want people to know is take what she said. Let's study what she's done and figure out what we can do next.
Describe your mom in one word. Oh, here, hang on. Describe her in one word as a mother and in another word as a civil rights leader.
As a mother?
Yeah.
Wow. See, and wait a minute. One word?
Yeah, just one word. You get one word to describe her before you die. You don't get a chance to say another one.
Nurturing, I'd say, for that.
Ooh, like it.
Now, the second one, what was the second?
The civil rights. As a civil rights leader, how would you describe your mom in one word?
A warrior.
Ooh. Describe the same question to your father.
But one word, see, this is good. Brilliant. The first word. As a civil rights supportive, because he is supportive of mother.
Yeah. So when the book about your mom is coming out?
Go
on the record.
You're gonna make me sweat now.
Go on the record.
I'd say within a couple of years. Let's put it that way, or sooner.
Why
it's a
long?
Lot. The problem is that you have to stop. You know, I love to travel, so you have to stop.
Yeah.
And concentrate completely on this, and so I think that it's going to happen a little bit more now. I also have to work with my older sister, the sister that was involved with this. Sit down and do it. The only way to do it is just designate time and put it out.
All this will disappear in 100 years if you keep messing around and not writing that book.
That is man, you're trying to make me feel bad, too. Boy. I'm going to have to go home right now and start typing this, which is good. I mean, hey, pressure is good.
Yeah, we put that on the record. So you say by December 31st, 2023, the book.
No. Oh. You said that, but... No, but I'm gonna be. It's gonna be underway at that time because I do realize that I need to finish my business, and it's a top priority for me.
Please, because you guys are you and your two sisters, the best people to tell the story about your mom.
That absolutely, because I don't want other people trying to tell the story of who she was because they have no idea.
Yeah,
who she was.
And which is gonna happen if you don't tell the story, somebody else is gonna write.
So we'll do it.
Yeah,
I'm on tomorrow. Let's say I'll be started definitely before then. We'll
tonight.
See if we can get it published.
I know it. Describe your sister Phyllis in one word.
Wow, one word. One word again.
Yeah, one word.
There, wait a minute. See, I can't pronounce this. Cerebral.
Cerebral.
Yeah, very bright and very much into thought about stuff because she's a professor.
So okay. How about your sister Linda?
Wow, that's a guy, man. You for that? See, this is kind of tough here. Creative.
Okay. Describe yourself in one word.
Nuts, maybe. Okay, wait a minute. Driven.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your father, Stanley Griffin Sr., your mother, the well-known activist, the civil rights pioneer in Iowa, Edna Griffin. You heard here first, man, from Edna Griffin's own son, Stanley Griffin Jr., talking about the family legacy.
And what I want to say, people, Iowans, let's get together. Come together. Forget all this fluff about what people try to say on the internet. Let's come together. Help somebody doing something.
Yeah.
Let's do it, okay?
Absolutely. Man, thanks for listening to the Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. That was Stanley Griffin from the great Griffin family. Until next time, be safe.
Bye.